This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 23. This week, I'm pleased to be talking with Gayla Treo, a gardening guru from Toronto, Ontario, who runs a gardening blog the likes of which you may have not seen before, called You Grow Girl. I've followed Gayla since she released her first book in 2005, and I've always appreciated her voice and perspective in the gardening world. Frustrated by the media's portrayal of perfect gardens, the perception that gardening was for old ladies and housewives with time on their hands, and brutally bored with most gardening books, Gayla set out to change the conversation around gardening and prove that it can be fun, accessible, and for all ages. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. Welcome to another episode. I'm so happy you could join me and listen in today. I've got a great guest on, Gayla Treo. Isn't that the best name for a gardener? A powerhouse in the gardening world who has been running her site, You Grow Girl, for 15 years. She's also the author of 3 books. Gayla has done a lot to change the conversation around gardening. She's an expert, but rather than get all technical, she's a big proponent of starting small, scaling back your expectations, and just experimenting. As someone who knows, I've had a lot of gardening successes and blunders. Gardening isn't for the faint-hearted. Not because it's hard. I really think we overcomplicate things when it comes to gardening. As Gayla puts it, plants want to grow. But because it's a commitment, plants are a responsibility and they need you to take care of them. But once you get the hang of it by starting slow and expanding with your comfort level, trust me, you'll be hooked. Especially when it comes to growing food. The rewards are huge and you'll find nothing rivals the taste of your own tomato. I wanted to get Gayla on the show because, well, it's spring and personally I've been getting my hands dirty starting seeds and prepping my vegetable garden and the time felt right to get you inspired. Also, with the start of our spring submission period for Pure Green in Season, so much of our conversation is revolving around local food, and it doesn't get more local than your patio or yard. Gayla and I keep things simple with a mind toward the beginner gardener and talk about how to get started with your first couple of plants. We talk a lot about not being limited by your surroundings. Even surrounded by concrete, you can grow a ton of things. We cover a lot of topics, but really it's only scratching the surface. If your curiosity is piqued by the episode and you want to know more, be sure to check out Gayla's website, yougrowgirl.com, and we've also been publishing a guide on starting seeds over on puregreenmag.com. So, here's Gayla. All right, so thank you so much, Gayla, for coming on today. I'm really excited to talk to you about gardening.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me, how did you get your start, you know, in gardening?
I always laugh every time I get that question because everybody asks me. It's a natural question to ask, but my way of coming into gardening, I think, is a little bit unusual. So it's always a hard question to answer. It was very much in stops and starts for me. In the beginning, it was impulsive, I guess. It was something that I needed to do, but I didn't understand it. I didn't think about it in a conscious way. It wasn't like I thought, I really want to have a garden. It was more like it just happened. And I also don't come from a very traditional, what I think of as a traditional gardening background, in the sense that I didn't grow up around gardens. My biggest influence that I think of, that I, you know, realized later on was an influence, was my grandmother, who lived in a senior's apartment building. And I remember as a little kid going out onto her balcony and exploring, and there were some buckets, some white buckets, with a plant coming out of it that had a little blue flower. And I went in and I asked her what it was, and it was potatoes. And I think that served as an influence to me later on, because I didn't have a traditional gardening space, to understand that I could grow something like a potato in a bucket on a balcony. You know, that you don't have to have an in-ground garden to have a food garden to grow food. Other than that, there really weren't, and she didn't talk about gardening. So other than that, there were really no obvious influences, and I didn't grow up in a place where there were, you know, backyards and gardens. So when I did start gardening, and like I said, it wasn't starts and stops, it was a surprise to me. And when I finally shift in the sense that I started and didn't ever stop again, that was a real surprise to me and to everybody around me. And it took me a few years to even acknowledge the fact that what I was doing was really gardening and that I was a gardener.
So what was it about you that surprised you so much? Just that you liked it? Or
I think it's because I didn't grow up with it around me, that I had this outside idea of what gardening was, and that was very formed by popular media. So popular magazines of the time, television shows, books, everything that I looked at, I didn't see myself in it. I didn't see somebody who had, you know, lived in urban spaces, had very small spaces. I mean, every book that I looked at that said it was for small spaces, those spaces look huge to me comparatively. Yeah. And they were very, for lack of a better word, bougie. I mean, they looked expensive and they were very focused on aesthetics. I think at the time food gardening was still this thing that people did, but they did kind of hidden behind the garage in the back. It wasn't out in the open as much as it could have been. And even when it was, because here in Toronto, there are people who are growing right out in the front, growing food right out in the front. It didn't get the respect that it deserved. It was seen as sort of a low class thing. So, I just didn't see my own experiences reflected in what was around me. It also seemed to be a very different demographic than me, older. Mm-hmm. I was quite young at the time. So, in that sense, I think that's why it took me so long to come around to, oh yeah, I am actually gardening, and I am a gardener, and I can be a gardener despite the fact that I don't look like what I think it is that I'm supposed to look like.
No, true, definitely. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I, similar to you, I sort of garden starts and stops, and I had some years that were really successful and others that were not. And it's easy to get discouraged because those images that you see in gardening magazines, that's what you're aspiring to. And you think that you are a good gardener if you can achieve that.
Yeah.
And it's really hard, and, you know, it's a full-time thing. And so, you know, there's that too. I mean, there's a lot of expectations to manage for sure. So for you, you started to realize that, you know, you were a gardener, but when did you start really, really getting into it and experiencing success as a gardener in your own sort of way?
So I think when I really got into it, when, like I said, when I started and then I didn't ever stop.
Yeah.
around 1997 or 1998, something like, no, maybe it was earlier than that. I moved into my apartment around late 94, I think. So maybe it was 96, something like that. It was in the later 90s.
So one of the things that I've definitely noticed about you is that you are definitely talking to a different demographic. You kind of touched on that before when you said that you noticed it wasn't for people like you. And when you say like you, you're talking about urban, younger people. In your book, you talk about being frugal, so not a lot of money to throw at it. And so you're kind of bringing gardening to the people, kind of those under 40, let's say, and focusing on the challenges that young urban people face. So I wondered if you could just share a little bit more about your philosophy and why you felt so compelled to share that particular message.
Oh, I mean, I think because it was so needed. I, mm-hmm. like I said, I felt so outside of what I thought I was supposed to be and what I was supposed to have in order to garden. And then here I was doing it, and then suddenly realizing, oh, I am actually a gardener, and it doesn't have to look a particular way. It can look a completely different way. Gardening is just so much more open-ended than people give it credit for. The funny thing is, though, that I've been doing the site for 15 years now, and now I am 40. I am over 40. I am now the demographic, and yet I've realized that I'm still not the demographic. So I think that now has made me realize just how limiting that picture is.
Right, exactly. So talking about it, you mean like within a certain demographic is limited, you mean?
Well, I guess, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of like the mainstream garden media is about, it's about selling. And mm-hmm. so they're selling to a really quantifiable demographic. And I think the thing is, there's just a lot of us who exist outside of that. And that's growing, fortunately. And I'm really glad to see that.
Yeah, definitely. So what does your garden look like now?
Now, a little bit closer to, you know, I think what people expect, a little bit closer to a real garden, in quotes, only that after 16 years in an apartment, I moved further north and I'm now in a house with a backyard. It's still an urban backyard. It's especially an urban Toronto backyard. It's very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it is small, certainly small by, you know, suburban expectations. And it is a mix because I'm an equal opportunity plant addict in the sense that I love food, and food is where I definitely have a passion for food, but I also still love ornamentals. There are plants, a lot of plants that I grow that don't have an edible use, although they often do have some other kind of use. So I do have a mix between, I think of all of my garden as a working garden, but I think I'm better now at bridging between the aesthetic appeal and the just hard and fast usefulness.
Yes, that's a tough one.
Partly I have an art background, so that I want to be creative. But I also mm-hmm. am still about usefulness, and that's partly because of space. I only have so much space, so I want to get as much as I can out of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you mentioned that you said you'd noticed the demographics and ideals surrounding gardening changing since you started writing about it. So what have been sort of the biggest things that you've noticed shifting?
Definitely food has come out into the open, and I think that's a really positive thing for a lot of reasons. And also organic, talking about sustainability, that shift is huge because when I published my first book, that was in 2005, I was not allowed to put organic in the title.
Really?
Even though wow. I am an organic gardener, I've always followed organic practices. I wasn't allowed to put organic in the title because it was seen as marginal.
Huh.
And then when I did my next book, it was like, yes, please do put organic in the title.
Yeah,
so that's a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Weirdo to the norm.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big shift then for sure. What was the time span between those two books?
5 years.
5 years. Yeah, so that's pretty quick then. I mean, that's great. I mean, definitely. Is there anything else that you've noticed really shifting, or has it mostly been focused around food that you've seen those changes?
I think that's probably one of the major changes because food did really move into the foreground in a lot of ways. And this, you know, focus on growing your own. It used to be, like I said, considered to be like in quotes, a low class thing. It was kind of hidden. It was definitely not appreciated, and now it is. Now it's right out in the foreground, and people are incorporating edible plants into their ornamental gardens, and I can't believe how many people are now really enthusiastic about starting food gardens and making space for a food garden that never would have before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as you said, you mentioned quickly about, you know, people even turning their whole front yards. They're forsaking their lawns for these veggie gardens, which is great.
Yeah.
So why do you think we're starting to see this shift, or we have seen this shift? I don't think it's starting. I think it's established for sure.
It is. And I think it comes from a lot of different places that just sort of came together at the same time. It was a shift in, you know, a cultural shift in terms of our ideas about urban living, ideas about food and sustainability, and food security. It was like all these political ideas, these different cultural ideas, and then DIY movement really taking form and growing. So it was a lot of all of these things coming together at the right time.
Mm-hmm. And now, even though you said that you're no longer that, you know, young early 20s demographic that you were when you started, but are you starting to see more young people taking up the hobby or the whatever you want to call it?
I am. I think there's still a lot of, in the garden world, there's still a lot of sort of nail biting around whether are the kids going to garden, you know, are there going to be gardeners? And I think the thing is there are, but I think it's just a harder thing to track. Like, for example, in the past, you would be a part of a horticultural society and you would get together locally with other people in your horticultural society. And now so much of that is happening online that those groups are, I think their populations are aging and diminishing. So, you know, there's this nail biting of there's no young kids gardening. And I think they are, they're just not drawn to those groups.
Right. I can see. Yeah, I can understand that for sure. So for the purpose of this podcast, I wanted to focus on veggie gardening. Our spring submission period, listeners will probably know this, for a project that we lead called Pure Green in Season is underway, and spring is the time to get everything going, so it just seems right, you know, the timing seems right to talk about producing our own food in whatever capacity, you know, each person can muster. So the comment that I hear most often about gardening is that it seems overwhelming and intimidating. So how do you present it in a way that seems accessible and fun?
Well, the first thing is expectation. I think most beginners go into it thinking that if they kill things, they're a bad gardener. Mm-hmm. And I have to keep repeating this every year, but I kill things. I kill plants all the time. That's just part of it's part and parcel of the experience of gardening. We don't control nature. Gardening is very humbling in the sense that there's a part of us that is doing it, you know, we're cultivating in order to seek control, but then at the same time, we actually don't have any control. So things die. Sometimes plants die because we're neglectful, or we don't know what we're doing. And then other times they die just because we don't know why they die. The season's not the same. You know, some seasons are colder and wetter than other seasons, and so some plants won't do as well, but then others will do better. Sometimes the plants just aren't viable for whatever reason, and they don't survive. So letting go of that worry is really important. Starting small, I think, is maybe a difficult thing to do, because sometimes when you start something and you're really excited, you just kind of go all in.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is overwhelming. And I had forgot how overwhelming it can be until I moved to this place and had this empty yard. And even though it's not a big yard by suburban standards, it was still a pretty big empty space, bigger than I had ever had. And I do remember thinking, wow, yes, this is what it feels like to be a beginner. I had forgot. just having this blank slate that I have to fill.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that pressure on top of it all to make it look good.
Well, I can imagine that pressure for you is heightened even.
it's exciting, but then it is also scary. And then, you know, knowing that if I had started out with a space that large in the beginning, it would have been very intimidating, because I wouldn't have, you know, I would have put things in the wrong places. I would have done everything wrong. So I think I was in some ways lucky to start out with such small confined spaces, because I could only fit so much in. I could only push so hard in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. No, that's very true. And I loved what you said about gardening being humbling, and that your expectations is the number one thing. That's where you start, because all you can do is create ideal conditions, and then the rest is left to Mother Nature, and you can't control that. And it's really important to realize, I think, early on for sure.
And remember that next year is a new year and it's going to be different. And
yeah,
to try to go back to it with a renewed sense of hope. Next year, everything's going to be different. You don't know what's going to happen, and try to approach that from a place of excitement rather than a place of fear.
Yes, exactly. I have noticed that this year, it's my first year starting seeds. And I've noticed that, well, I shouldn't say that. I've always sort of planted seeds in the garden, but to me that felt a lot like, I'm talking veggie gardening right now. It always seemed a little less scary because I just popped them in the ground and I kind of forgot about them. And I kept an eye out for them to sprout, and it sort of felt very hands off. But this year I started seeds indoors, and that felt very much like a babying process. I've been a lot more worried about them than I was before. So I can see how, I really invested it. I really want it to work, but really you can't control it. I mean, I had a couple tomatoes inexplicably die. I don't know why, but I had way too many. I started too many.
Right.
So it wasn't a bad thing, but so what are some of the biggest mistakes that beginner gardeners make? And what are some solutions to some of those things? Like, I know you talked about expectations, but are there some other things that you constantly see people do?
One thing that happens really often with containers, especially, is trying to put too many plants into one container.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that, I think, it's for a couple of reasons. And this is especially around tomatoes, because tomatoes, when you buy them at the store, they're only a couple of inches high. And while there are a lot of different types of tomatoes with different growth habits, there are, vining tomatoes that can grow to be incredibly monstrous plants. And it's really hard as a beginner to conceptualize the fact that something that's only in a 4-inch pot could possibly, within the span of the season, become something that's like 8 feet tall. So the other thing is, if oftentimes when you're buying tomatoes, if you're buying transplants at the store, they're often sold in the 4-pack, the cell pack, where you get 4, in individual cells. And so what happens is you have these 4 tiny plants and people want to put all 4 into the same pot, and then they die.
Mm.
Or they get a little bit of height and they don't produce anything. And that's because a container is literally a contained space, and the plants have nowhere to go. So they're very dependent on you to meet their needs, their water needs, their nutrition needs, and then, of course, space. They need root space, and tomatoes are a great example of that because they produce very big roots. So it's really, you need to understand, you need to have that, and I think that comes from experience, understanding that this little thing is actually going to become this massive thing, and it's going to need a lot more space.
Okay, so really read those labels.
Yeah.
Because usually they tell you how far, but it's easy to ignore. And like you said, you have these 4 tiny things, and then your container kind of looks a little crappy for a while because it's so sparse.
So one rule of thumb that I always, that I tell people is, if you can mix edibles in a container, but it's important to understand the different types of edibles and what it is that they're trying to achieve. So mm-hmm. plants like tomatoes or peppers or eggplants, that sort of thing, that produce fruit, tend to, as a general of them, need more space, more water, more nutrition. And so it's better if you have a big container, and you should grow food in big containers, as big as you can get and can handle, because they really need it. To get a big container and just do one fruit-producing plant in that container, and then put other plants around it. So plants like lettuces, salad greens, even herbs, and even flowers that are not going to produce fruit, because then they won't be in competition for space and also for the same type of nutrition and water.
Okay, so when you say fruit, you're talking like anything, like tomatoes or like a pepper plant, or probably tomatoes is the most common one, but anything like that.
Yes, yes. Technically, mm-hmm. tomatoes are a fruit. So anything that is mm-hmm. zucchini, that sort of thing.
Cucumbers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's because those types of plants really suck a lot of nutrients out of the ground.
Nutrition, they need root space usually more so than other plants do, but also water, because when you think about it, a tomato a tomato plant is producing these watery fruits, and that a lot of water needs to go into that process in order to make that watery fruit. Whereas a basil plant is just producing leaves, and while there's a lot of water in leaves, it's not the same as that tomato plant that needs the water in the leaves and in the fruit.
Mm-hmm, of course. That makes sense, like you said. So I'd planned to ask you about container gardening, but I think we should just talk about it now. What are some of the other things to keep in mind? So you said if your plan is to include some, you know, edible plants like herbs and like, let's say, tomatoes, what sort of size is sort of the minimum size that you think, and what kind of soil should we be filling it with?
Size, I always say go for the biggest that you can, because a bigger container is going to provide more root space, more nutrition, and it doesn't need to be watered as often. It's not going to dry out as quickly. So you'll have more success with a larger container than you will with a whole bunch of tiny ones. But obviously, you know, price is an issue there. So the other thing I suggest is that people go looking for containers in places that are not necessarily the garden center, because a big container in a garden center is going to cost more than, say, a garbage can.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of using things that are not necessarily made for gardening, like garbage cans are a great example. I remember the first year that I wanted to grow tomatoes on my roof, and it was very hot out there, and there was no outdoor tap. I went to a garden place. It was actually IKEA. I went to the IKEA Garden Center, and they had these big self-watering pots that were really expensive. They were like $25 or something, which for me at the time was a lot of money. And I could only afford to get one. And on the way out, I saw, actually, that's not true. I was going to get two. And on the way out towards the cash, I saw a display of these nice looking gray garbage cans that were big. And they even had a top that you could take off and use as a tray underneath. And they were $10. So I was able to get four for the same price, well, actually for less than the price of two of these expensive containers that were actually smaller than the garbage can. And I ended up using them for over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
The only thing was I just needed drainage. So drainage is really important. Make sure you put drainage holes in anything that you buy. I think beginners get fooled by this because there are containers, even in the garden center, that don't have drainage holes in them. And so people think, well, if they don't come with drainage holes, then they must not need drainage holes. Unfortunately, that's a product of the garden industry and aesthetics. It's like these containers that look good but aren't actually practical. So it's really important to make sure that whatever you use has drainage, especially for food plants.
Okay. Yeah, and if you don't have like a drill or something like that to put a hole in the bottom or but a couple holes, then you can put in like bigger rocks and sort of get around it that way, right?
A little bit, but it's harder to manage outside because the plants are out there in the environment. You know, it rains. You don't know how much it's going to rain. So the rock thing can be a little bit difficult to manage when we're talking about outdoor gardening. Indoor gardening, it's certainly a lot more manageable.
Okay.
You had your other question was, about soil. So soil is tricky too, because there are a lot of options out there, but they're not very good.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about a container, we're talking about soilless mix, which is not really soil in the same sense of the soil that's in the ground, which is a living organism. What you're putting into a container, a soilless mix, is it's an approximation, but it's constructed in such a way to avoid compacting in the container. So you can get away with putting soil from your outdoor garden into a container if it's good loamy, so like light and cakey soil. But for the most part, most of the soil that you might try to put into a container from in the ground, it's fine in the ground. It's great in the ground, but in a container, it becomes very hard and compacted like cement, and it'll suffocate the roots of the plant and cause rotting and they'll die. So you really need to go buy soilless mix from the store. And my advice is, if you can't find a brand that you really trust, to just look for the most inert kind of mix. So a mix that just has perlite and vermiculite and maybe and coir, which is a more sustainable alternative to peat. I mean, peat is mostly what you're going to find, but try to look for coir if you can. Mm-hmm. And I say that because a lot of, if you're trying to grow organically, a lot of the soilless mixes that are out there have fertilizers in them that are not organic. So if you're trying to grow organically, you're better off buying something that is fairly inert and doesn't have any fertilizing in it, and then adding your own.
Okay. So all of that is fairly clear on the bag, I'm assuming, once you go and take start looking.
Yes. If you look around on the bag, you will find a list of ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, like, for example, like Miracle-Gro or a company like that that sells soil that contains fertilizers in it is pretty obvious, I'm guessing, by looking at the bag.
Yes. And then others, mm-hmm. I mean, you'll see the little pellets in there as well, these weird little pellet balls that there's nothing like that in nature. So those are usually the chemical fertilizers. One thing that I do too, in terms of leading people to what to pick in terms of soil in the store is to lift up the bag. Mm-hmm. I find there are a lot of cheap options. Soil is one place where you really want to spend your money. Save your money on the containers. You can save money on plants by growing from seed and whatnot, but where you really want to spend your money is in the soil. So if you pick up a bag and it's really heavy, chances are good that it's got a lot of compost in it and it's going to get too compacted in the container. If you pick up one that's really light, like feels kind of like popcorn in terms of the weight versus the size ratio, that is usually one that doesn't have a whole lot of ingredients in it. And so I usually say go for that one and then add, you can buy something like sea kelp separately, add your own compost in, just make sure you don't add too much. That's another mistake that people make when they're mixing up their own mixes, is they put too much compost in. And so I would always say don't go more than 25% compost.
Okay.
Because any more than that and you're getting into that area again where it's going to get too compacted in the container and suffocate your plants. I know this sounds really intimidating. I think mixing your own soil, adding fertilizers, especially when it's organic and it's not just, you know, something out of a bottle, scares people. But it's really forgiving. It is quite forgiving. It's not an exact science. It's not like when I go to make my mix, I don't necessarily think, if I add any more, you know, a tablespoon more than I should of sea kelp, that, you know, everything's going to go awry. It won't.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. And that's also funny about the soil. I didn't know that trick. And it sort of seems counterintuitive. You know, you think heavy, that's good. It's full of good stuff. But then, you know, for that purpose of container gardening, it's not necessarily, well, it isn't good, like you said.
And sometimes it is. Yeah. Sometimes it is full of good stuff. But sometimes, unfortunately, if it's not a very reputable brand, it can be full of garbage, basically fillers, cheap stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yes, yeah, I mean, it is a little intimidating, I guess, because, you know, you need to find that good source. But once you do, and once you've tried it a couple of times, it's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about urban gardening, you know, how do you sort of teach or train people to see opportunity where they thought they may not have had none? You know, like they're just feeling really limited by a lack of space, or, you know, they're looking at their tiny patio and, or just, you know, surrounded by concrete kind of thing. Like, is there anything that you tell people to sort of help them see the opportunity that surrounds them to grow something?
That's tricky, because it does mean sort of a paradigm shift in your head in terms of, you have to let go, first of all, of what you think is appropriate. You know, what you think it is that you can and can't do. I mean, any plants want to grow. And I think every space has its pros and cons. Even the what seem like the best spaces still have their negatives. So for example, you know, I didn't have when I really got going, I just had the roof, and the roof had no outdoor water tap, and it was very hot and very exposed. And it did take a long time to understand what worked and didn't work in that kind of environment and how to make it work for me. But then once I did, I started to see all the positives. Like when there was a year that was very cold and wet and everybody was suffering tomato blight in the ground and their peppers didn't taste very good. You know, they had all kinds of issues, and I had no issues with my plants on the roof. They were as productive as ever, because with containers I could control the amount of water that they were getting, and then also they were getting a lot more sun because of the exposure. And things like hot peppers, for example, do better in containers than in the ground, because you can control the amount of water that they get. Oftentimes, if they get too much water, they might be very productive, but then be tasteless and bland and not have that heat that you want. So it's just, I think it does take time to understand that there are opportunities where you don't think there are, and positives where you don't think there are.
Yes, well, definitely. And like you said, seeing the opportunity, like I wouldn't have thought actually to, I don't know why, but to plant in a garbage can or something like that. And once you start seeing those opportunities, more and more start coming up. And something I find I'm really intrigued by actually is vertical gardening. So trying to train plants to climb up as opposed to sprawl out. I mean, even though I live in a rural area, I've got lots and lots of space, but I found that I can't keep up with weeds.
Right.
You know, I guess the soil's nice and it's productive, but weeds like it a lot. So if I had too much space, I just couldn't stay on top of it. And then I had to, like, I remember one year literally where I had, like, the frost came and I saw on the ground like what seemed like dozens of rotten tomatoes, because I didn't even know they were there, hidden under the weeds. You know, it just took over. So I'm really interested in this idea of vertical gardening to take up less space, but the principle works very well for urban areas too, where you're limited by space.
Right.
So sort of what is the basic idea there, and how, where can people find out more about trying out that practice?
Well, the way that I think about it is just making use of, because you only have so much in terms of footprint, making use of upward, you know, the space above, which is almost kind of limitless. So, for example, growing indeterminate vining tomatoes, which grow very tall, as opposed to, you know, shorter ones that determinants that grow like a bush, and even though they can be quite productive and are especially good in containers, you can think in terms of, if I have a bigger container, then I can do a taller indeterminate one. I feel like I have to go back, because you were talking about weeds, and I was going to ask you if you do you mulch?
Well, at the time I tried to, but you know, it was one of those. We had converted a big chunk of lawn, and so fighting the grass was just really hard. And then we made the mistake of mulching with hay, because I have a horse.
Yeah.
And hay is pretty prolific. So there was a lot of things growing out of that. And then I had this idea in my head. My mom had a beautiful garden, and it was bare earth, and I actually know a bit more about that, and that's not necessarily a good thing either, but it looked really nice, and so I was kind of going for that. So I tried a whole bunch of things, and none of the wood chips, different things like that, and it was hard. So this year, I mentioned to you, I'm going with raised beds, because I feel like it's a more sort of controlled, smaller area, and then laying landscaping cloth in the areas that I walk on, and then putting wood chips over that.
Right. I am such an advocate for mulch, and not just for people who have big spaces, but even in containers. It's one of those things that works for in the ground and in containers, and you don't realize it. It really helps to hold in moisture. I mean, you don't have to worry as much in containers about things like weeds, but I found that when I was gardening on the roof, like I said, very exposed, a lot of wind, and wind is a particularly difficult thing because it dries out container soil very quickly. Having the mulch as a protective barrier really kept the moisture in, and it meant that because I didn't have an outdoor tap, I had to haul buckets of water out to water my plants, and it made such a big difference mulching those containers. So even raised beds, I mulch my raised beds. I mulch everything, and as long as you get straw. That's the important thing, is find a source for straw that actually really is straw and not hay, because you're right. If you get hay, they have the seed in them, the grass seed, and that is really that's introducing weeds to a situation where you were trying to keep the weeds down. So that's infuriating. But other than that, but if you could find, I love straw. I mean, there are a lot of other options, but I find in our area particularly, straw is the easiest to come by. And then you can use things like newspaper and stuff too, if you don't have straw, but I still, I prefer straw, and aesthetically, I do like the way that it looks.
Yeah, it's so country garden. I don't know. I like it too. And just walking on it, it's comfortable, and you sit on it, it's nice and clean. I like it a lot too. So straw is your mulch of choice. And you mentioned newspaper. What about wood chips or what else might you use?
Well, I use wood chips, but I use them on the pathways. For walking on. I don't use them on the vegetable garden, and I use the smaller wood mulch for some of my ornamental beds, but then I have other beds that are dry beds where I grow hardy cacti and other plants that are very drought tolerant and need that good drainage, so because I have sandy soil. So there I use rocks or pebbles as the mulch. Cocoa mulch is a great thing to use. The only problem, it's a byproduct of the cacao, so the chocolate making process. The only problem is I have a dog now, and that's toxic to dogs, so not an option for me now. But it is a good option otherwise. It's very lightweight.
Oh, okay. When I lived in Florida for a little while, and we used peanut shells there.
Right. That's the thing. There's buckwheat shells are really popular in some other areas. It's all very regional. So I find for this region, wood chips is obviously in abundance, but then wood chips aren't the best for a vegetable garden. So for vegetables, I find straw is the best option other than cacao. But again, if you have a dog, you don't want to use that.
So you mentioned that mulching is really good for holding in moisture, but it's good for other reasons too. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but to help keep nutrients in the soil rather than sort of evaporating out. Is that a factor at all, or not really? Not in a container anyway.
It's more about the water. Although I will say, in terms of the soil quality, I always mulch my beds at the end of the season before I go into the winter, just to avoid the dust bowl effect. So, over the winter time, the wind and whatnot sort of knocking the good soil off of the top. So mulch holds everything in, holds the soil in. And I actually, the other thing that I do for that is I, rather than pulling everything out of the raised beds, which are more or less annual growing beds, I do have perennials in too, but for the most part, they're annual beds. I don't, for example, in the beds where I grow my tomatoes, I don't pull the roots out. I cut the stem and leave the roots in, and that's another way to help hold the soil in place over the winter time, and it also helps to put something back into the soil because the roots decompose a little bit and improve the soil slightly that way too. So I find my soil is much better as a result of doing that. Mulch can also encourage certain critters to come around, which can be bad because it can encourage slugs because it stays moisture, but then at the same time it also encourages beetles that eat the slugs. So I always think of it as they're sort of going toe to toe. I don't worry about the slugs too much.
Oh, you don't? Last year we had a really bad season of slugs. It was pretty bad. Oh,
it
was horrible.
It was wet.
Yeah. Ugh, and they ate my plants badly. So you mentioned briefly about soil. Like, so you said you have sandy soil, and this wasn't a question I had planned on asking you, but I'm curious about it now. I've actually just recently been learning about soil. And how do you tell what kind of soil you have? And then what does that tell you? So how can that inform what you do next?
Well, the most obvious way is to just pick some up and feel it. I mean, if your if your soil is sandy, you're going to feel that right off the bat. You know, squeeze the soil in your hand. If it really stays together, has a slickness to it, it's probably got a lot of clay. If it's really compacted, hard to dig into, it's probably got a lot of clay. Loamy soil, like I said, is that ideal that most, especially food gardeners, are trying to attain because it's very rich and it has that crumbly, cakey feeling that people talk about. You know, smell and taste are other ways to sort of ascertain certain things about your soil, but definitely at the most obvious is just picking it up. You can also put some into, you know, dig some out, put it into a jar, add water, and see how the different layers settle, and that can give you an idea of the composition. So moving here, I was very surprised to have sandy soil because I'm nowhere near the lake yet, because I had seen some gardens near Lake Ontario that were extremely sandy. You know, they're practically almost on the beach in terms of the amount of sand in their soil. I'm not quite that extreme here. It's more like a loamy sand. I really don't have clay, and I had always had a lot of clay in my soil before, so that was definitely a new thing here. It changes a lot. It changes the composition of the soil. It changes the nutrition. It also changes how water is distributed, because before I got an idea, you know, before I realized that I had sandy soil here, I had this idea that I was going to do all of these beds and I was going to use soaker hose system throughout to irrigate. And the problem with the soaker hose is it doesn't work with sandy soil because all the water just goes directly down wherever it is. Whereas normally with the soaker hose, because it comes out so slowly, the water, if it's a more clay-like soil, the water will be distributed more along the surface. But with the sandy soil, it just goes straight down. So I had to figure out a completely different way of watering my garden.
So, okay. I mean, yeah, definitely there's challenges. And I would imagine that clay holds water more. And like you said, sand, it just goes straight down. So so then if people are finding that they have, you know, so loam is what you want. So if you've got clay or if you have sand, how do you amend that? Like, I know it takes time, but what does the process start out as?
This is why I always recommend raised beds. I mean, I think that some soils are much more difficult and costly and time-consuming to amend than others, especially if you have an extremely sandy soil, for example, that can be very difficult, or a really compacted soil that can be very difficult to amend. And so with a raised bed, you're just going right on top of it and kind of, you know, making better conditions for yourself on the surface of it. So, and then building it up more slowly over time. So I think it's the better option. And for part of this garden, that is what I did. I have raised beds going all along one side. That's because the soil was so sandy and also because the yard was not flat. It kind of bowed and it's hilly in multiple directions. And so having a raised bed really allowed me to fix that problem.
Okay, that makes sense. So just start fresh.
Yeah. And I was able to do it very cheaply. I mean, I hardly had to buy anything at all because there was a whole bunch of wood left in the shed here. And I built most of it just with the wood that was left behind and then had to buy a couple of pieces and that was it. I did it almost for nothing. And then
nice.
I know, that was pretty great. In terms of amending the soil, the soil where, especially where I didn't do the raised beds, I went with duck manure, which I wouldn't have in my more clay gardens, but I needed a lot of soil amender that wasn't too expensive. And I know people tend to jump to something like a triple mix, but that kind of stuff usually has a lot of sand in it. And I didn't need to add more sand. I really just needed nutrition. Mm-hmm. And the duck manure, it was a composted duck manure that I think had been composted with wood chips. So it had a lot of organic matter and a lot of nitrogen, and it was very, very lightweight. So it ended up being the perfect amender for my sandy-ish soil.
Okay. So basically looking for composted manure is a good thing, probably for any garden. Okay. So I wanted to ask you briefly about, you know, what you need to think about in order to garden sustainably. So especially when you're talking about growing food, because, you know, you don't want to add extra chemicals. So what are the things people need to keep an eye out for and know about sustainable gardening?
Oh, there's a lot.
Of course.
Water is a really obvious one, because especially food gardens need water. I mean, I talked about how I have a dry bed. So that's a bed that I'm really making use of the type of soil I already have here, which is quite sandy, and I'm not amending it, and I'm only growing plants in it that really like it dry. So I don't have to water that bed at all. But obviously for food, I do have to consider water. So a rain barrel, always got to recommend the rain barrel, because it's catching the water that's, you know, coming down from the sky and making use of that. And that water is also so much better than water out of the hose, because it's not, you know, chlorinated city water that has other chemicals in it. So water is a big one. And then also thinking about your garden as an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to achieve a kind of balance with it. So gardening sustainably is about, one, understanding the soil as a living organism and really encouraging the soil and the soil's health, encouraging all of those organisms that live in healthy soil to live in your soil, because that means that your plants are going to be a lot happier. they're going to be healthier. You're not going to need to add, you know, the problem with chemical fertilizers is it's a never-ending system of input. You have to keep putting in and keep putting in. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you work towards growing healthy soil, healthy living soil, it kind of reaches its own balance. And then taking that idea to the garden as a whole. So, you know, promoting beneficial insects to come in and help deal with pests, for example. So no spraying. I mean, I used to advocate for, you know, spraying with natural stuff, but I don't even do that now, which means getting comfortable with squishing things.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. You don't want certain things. Really, the best way to get rid of them is your fingers.
Yeah, I imagine that does take a bit of getting used to.
It does. And learning, it does also take learning what's good and what is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people come to it very squeamish about all insects and all wormy, squirmy things. And so it takes some learning about which insects and which wormy, squirmy things you want to have and you want to encourage, as opposed to the ones that you don't.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I know I kind of hate digging in the dirt only because I feel really bad every time I chop one in a worm with my spade.
But I think it's okay with worms, because I think they keep living anyway, as long as you don't chop into the part where their organs are.
Yeah, I know, but I can't imagine it feels all that good.
No.
I don't know. I don't know. It's a funny thing that I have, but... Yeah. And I would imagine too that, you know, just thinking about the sustainability part, thinking about what grows naturally in your area is probably pretty big too. You know, I think in your book you talk about, in your first one, about not trying to grow an English garden in Las Vegas and
Not trying to force what is not logical for your space, because that's going to lead to a lot of heartbreak, a lot of expense, and mm-hmm. and yeah, it's really not sustainable.
No, it isn't. So just my last question for you, assuming that, you know, listeners are just starting out and they're going to try container gardening because it's a way that you can control, you know, a lot of those factors that you talked about, and you can start small and stay organized, what would you suggest in terms of vegetable gardening to start with, like sort of like your five top or easy or whatever plants?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I really do believe that regardless of what's easy, you do want to start with something that you really want to eat, because mm-hmm. radishes may be easy, for example, but if you don't like radishes, there's really no point.
Yeah.
There's no point in putting the effort into growing them. And I think you're going to stay more committed if it's something that you're really excited about eating down the line. That said, I think that some of the easiest plants are the ones that don't have a long schedule, like tomatoes, for example, that are going to take, you know, 3 months until you get to the eating part. So mm-hmm. herbs I always recommend right off the bat, because herbs are some of the most, they produce very quickly. And so there's like a positive experience much earlier on that kind of keeps the momentum up. And then, of course, it's going to come down to what you like in terms of herbs, because there's a lot of variety there. But something like, everybody wants to grow basil. For the most mm-hmm. part, almost everybody wants to grow basil. Mm-hmm. And that can be one of the more finicky herbs. So the only issue there is to make sure you don't buy your basil too early. The stores start selling it really early because they want to get your money. And I think also because they don't even know that it shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be planted so early. But in our region anyway, I would say always wait for basil until the end of May, the beginning of June. It's just a mm-hmm. picky one. It does not like the cold and it doesn't like wet. Mm-hmm. But most of the herbs are actually really forgiving in all types of growing conditions. So in the ground, raised beds or containers, because they don't need a lot of nutrients, and they're quite drought tolerant. So sages, rosemary, lavender, thyme, especially oregano, those are really forgiving plants, and you're going to get food, you know, you're going to be able to harvest off of that right away. Mm-hmm. Salad greens, the only issue there is just to make sure you start early in the season. One mistake people make is they start lettuce in May. It's already too late. You can start lettuce pretty much as soon as the soil is workable. So as soon as it warms up, it's not frozen anymore, you can get, you know, your fingers into it, you can start sowing lettuce seeds. That's a really easy one. Don't go to the store and buy starts. Don't do the whole $4 for $2 or whatever it is for lettuce. It's so much cheaper if you just buy a pack of seed and just broadcast it, just distribute it across the soil surface, and you're done. So easy. Wow. What else is easy? I mean, tomatoes can be if you have the right conditions. So choose mm-hmm. the right variety for your conditions. If you are, you know, in a more northern climate where it's colder, then maybe you want to look for a variety that's from Russia or was developed somewhere cold and can handle the cold a little more. Don't go for like a Mexican variety that likes a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, if you're growing in containers, then you do need to consider the size of your container, because tomatoes vary so widely in terms of the size of the plant and the size of the fruit. Mm-hmm. I always recommend for beginner urban gardeners to start with something like a dwarf variety.
Okay.
They're harder to access. There aren't as many available, but they're much more forgiving in a smaller container.
Mm. Okay. That makes sense.
What else do we eat? beans. I think, you know, beans are actually quite easy, and they can be grown in a big container. If it's a pole bean, you can go for a more shallow container, like a foot or more deep, if you're growing the dwarf bushing beans. just make sure, again, with beans that you don't start too early, because like basil, they don't like the cold and the wet. They need to be started more, at least for our climate, in the getting into June, mm-hmm. when it's warm. Peas are another great one. You were talking about vertical, using vertical space, and peas are another great one for using vertical space. And yeah. and you can grow them in containers. For example, I like one called Dwarf Gray Sugar because it is a tall one, but it's not too tall. And I found that I could grow it in a pot that was only like a foot and a half, 2 feet deep, and without any trouble.
Oh, wow.
There's even one called Tom Thumb that only grows a few inches.
Oh, wow.
And still produces peas. So it's
really?
Possible even in a very diminutive container. Again, peas, though, are one that starts early in the season. So I just sowed my peas recently. It's a little later than usual, but we had a cold winter, so I started them a little bit later. Completely blanked out on the other food I was going to mention. But radishes, I talked about radishes. The other thing when I was saying what is easy and what's difficult, it really depends on your growing conditions because – in theory, radishes are very easy, yet when I was growing on my roof, it took me years before I got a decent radish harvest. So something mm-hmm. that should have been easy drove me to frustration because I had so much trouble growing it. And that was because I was growing in this very hot and dry climate, the growing conditions. Mm-hmm. And radishes, they like it cool and a little bit more on the moist side. At least in terms of growing in containers, you want to keep the container soil moist, not soaking, but moist. So it took me a few years before I finally figured out, oh, okay, this is how I grow them.
Yeah, there's a lot to know. It's definitely a science. I mean, like you said, plants want to grow, but then to get that really prolific, gorgeous plant, there's a lot to try and experiment with, as you said, for sure.
Yeah.
But those are all, go ahead.
I was just going to say, don't be discouraged if you have problems with something that somebody said was easy.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot. You know, some expert says blah, blah, blah is easy, and then you have trouble with it, and you're pulling your hair out, and you think, oh, I must be a black thumb. I can't have a garden because I can't grow X, Y, Z. And sometimes it really just does come down to your growing conditions and figuring out, you know, what it is that you're dealing with and how to grow that plant given the conditions that you have. So like I said, radishes should have been easy. You know, I may have already been considered an expert at that point and I still couldn't grow a radish to save my life.
Yeah, well, that's a really important point. I'm glad you said that. You know, just because someone said it was easy, it doesn't necessarily apply in all situations. So that's important for sure.
Yeah.
So are you suggesting that most of these plants, it sounds like you start from seed, you just directly sow them into the ground or your pot. Is that sort of what you're suggesting?
Not necessarily.
With these? Okay.
I grow a lot of things from seed because it's cheaper and there's more versatility. I mean, I can find varieties that are difficult to find locally as a transplant. But that said, there are still things that I do buy as a transplant. So perennial herbs, for example, rosemary, lavender. Although I did grow oregano from seed this year, but it was a variety that I've never been able to find. thyme. Even parsley, which is a biennial, not a perennial, I tend not to grow from seed because I'm not growing a lot of each of those plants. And, you know, I usually only need a couple at most of each of those plants. And growing from seed can take a lot of time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if you're starting from seed and you don't have a lot of space, especially if it's something that needs to be started indoors underneath lights, then, you know, it's a waste of space to grow something that's going to take forever to get to maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather use that space for my tomatoes, my coveted tomatoes, but anything that you can direct sow outside. So lettuce is one example. Like I mentioned, peas, beans, don't buy those as transplants. It's too expensive.
Yeah.
Much cheaper to buy from seed. And I find that the plants are healthier if they're grown on your own from seed. Like, for example, if you direct sow lettuce into a garden bed as opposed to buying a lettuce transplant from a store and sticking it into the bed, I find that the sown seeds last, they go further into the season. They can take the heat. They're a bit more tolerant of the heat than the transplants that you buy. They tend to fizzle out faster.
Okay, that's a good, definitely a good point to remember. So, I mean, we've covered a lot today, and there's lots and lots more to know. And like you said, you have been blogging for 15 years now, so there's a ton of information on your site. So I would definitely direct people there, which is just yougrowgirl.com. Are there any others, or like one particular book, like an encyclopedia type style, resource-based book that you really, really love, or no, not really?
Oh boy, no, I don't find those to be very good, very helpful books. Actually, I prefer the,
Well, that's good.
I prefer the smaller ones that are more focused, because then you get a lot more information about each particular thing, as opposed to one of those tomes that is just full of a lot of generalizations. So
yeah. Well, and of course, you have three books now. So you've got one that's sort of an introduction. You have another on food. And then your last one, the most recently, what is that one based on?
Herbs and Edible Flowers.
Oh, nice. That's a great topic. So definitely pick those up. So thank you so much, Gayla. I really appreciate your time. And I've really enjoyed our talk together. Was there anything else you wanted to add? Or?
I think the last thing I would want to say is that, you know, gardening is a lifelong learning experience. There is a lot to learn. And I know that can be incredibly intimidating. But if you think of it in terms of I'm going to spend my entire life learning about this, I can't possibly know everything. I hope that removes some of the intimidation factor and helps you to focus on the joy of the experience. I mean, every year you're going to lose a few things and you're going to have a few successes. So try to learn from both of them.
Yeah, that's really important. And I'm glad that you're ending with that for sure. And, you know, just find your rhythm. You'll find the things that speak to you and that you love. And eventually you'll just kind of have your own way of doing things. And that's perfectly okay too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Gayla. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So that concludes my talk with Gayla. Please share this episode with anyone you know who would be interested in learning a little more about starting their own garden, in the ground or in a container. Personally, I'm really ramped up for the season. My seedlings are thriving, my garden is almost prepped, and I just hope my resolve remains when those weeds start to creep in. As always, we've prepared detailed show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Gayla. And we've expanded on that simple soil test Gayla mentions using a mason jar, so be sure to check that out. Also, just another reminder to check out Gayla's site at yougrowgirl.com. If you want to know more on any topic, there's 15 years worth of gardening advice over there, so you're bound to find it helpful. Finally, PGM in Season, our community-based project all about eating and cooking with local food, is open for spring submissions. It's a year-long project that will culminate, hopefully all things going well, in a printed collaborative cookbook. Find out more about the project and how you can submit a recipe for a chance to be included in the final book at puregreenmag.com/puregreeninseason. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.